Okay, good morning. We started the lecture this week. Can you hear me? Yes. So today we continue with the lecture. So it is lecture 3, which corresponds to the chapter 3 in our textbook. So today we talk about the legal and ethical aspects of information security, which I believe is a very interesting topic for us, not because you will learn a lot of advanced skills or knowledge from this, but the topic itself gives us a lot of spaces, a big room for discussion and debate. As usual, we will go through some basic terms and the concept today. And then we will go through the long list of U.S. laws, EU laws. If we have time, we can have some few minutes for a short discussion about one interesting topic. At least personally, I think it is interesting to invest whether the future legislation and regulation can consider the technical trend. Today we call it the personalized services. And I will leave the last part, Norwegian law part, to you as a homework. I don't think we have time to go through all this. So the basic concept, if we talk about legal or regulation, which is relevant to information security, the first concept you should memorize is the term or the concept liability. So what is liability? It is a legal obligation. So it is a legal obligation of an entity extending beyond the criminal or contract law. So it demands more than criminal and contract law for you if you are operating information security services to your customer. It includes the legal obligation to make restitution, which is the second term, or you should memorize what is restitution. Basically, it is to provide some compensation for wrongs committed by a organization or its employees. So basically, restitution is a way to make compensation if the liability was breached. To better understand these two terms, two concepts, I share with you this. I think it is a case which is very thought-provoking. The case happened 2 years ago, roughly 2 years ago, end of year 2015. And there was a customer data breach with the company called VTech. So VTech is a company based on Hong Kong, providing infants and children toy for learning and education basis. Basically, they provide something like this, just a mini version or young kids version of adults' smartphones or digital cameras, something like that. And in that month, a journalist was contacted by a suspicious person, which was approved to be a hacker who broke into the VTech company server. So what were the consequences? The consequences are listed here. They found basically there was no information security measures deployed to protect the connection between the toy and the remote server. So what is the function of the remote server? The server can store a lot of personal information, which is the customer information, and also some media data, for example, captured by the toy, the pictures, audios captured by the toy. And you can imagine they are very sensitive, privacy sensitive data. And they found that basically there's no secure communication channel. There's no SSL or TLS deployed to encrypt the communication. And the password, yes, they set some password. And all the passwords are kept in the server in plain form. No hash, no SRP, no other technologies we talked about in last week's lecture. And the attacking vectors, the hacker used some very basic skills. It was not a novel skill, SQL injection attack, to launch a very successful attack to the server. And the consequences is 4.8 million of parent and 6.3 million of kids profile were leaked. And if we want to use some legal term to describe the situation, describe the status of the technology providers here, VTech, we should use one term here. We say it is, we call it grossly negligent, or say gross negligence. That means you should do some very basic things for enhance your information security of your product, but actually it did very little, if not zero. And of course, higher is the degree of gross negligence, here will be the liability in this case, right? So we talk about liability. And the question, next question will be how to reduce this liability. Any idea, if you are the CISO of this VTech, this company, what are you going to do to reduce the liability if all the things can be performed over again? And? Yes. And the other? From the management level, yes. Yeah, okay. Any other, or any people think about any technological improvement on this case? For example, if the you are a technician or security engineer. Yeah. Probably we can come up with a lot of ideas how to improve on this point from the technology aspects and the management aspects, as we mentioned. And before we come to the what happened to VT's response, what was their response to this vulnerability? And we should know two concepts. The first concept we called due care. That means as a technology provider in this case, you should always make information security know with attention paid by management, by all the employees in your organization. So the employee, all the employees should know what are acceptable behaviors, what are acceptable working style, what are acceptable technology or other information security measures should be taken to protect your products. And what could be the consequences of any bad thing happen? This is due care, so make people know. The second one, due diligence, which is go one step further. You should also make this always maintained to some degree. For example, by some awareness training, information security course training, and make a valid effort for all the protection and make this a continuous way. So we call it due diligence. Obviously, in this VTech case, we didn't see much due care. Probably yes, but at least they didn't respect the second principle, due diligence. So we see very little work down there, and we didn't see any history or record of maintenance as well. And what was the response from VTech? VTEC quietly updates its terms and the conditions, they call the T&C of the service. In the next month after the incident happened, they say the updated version says in the terms and the conditions, they says you acknowledge, here you means the potential buyers of their products, you acknowledge and agree that you assume full responsibility for your use of the site and any software or firmware downloaded therefrom. You acknowledge and agree that any information you send and receive during your use of the site might not be secure and may be intercepted. So the way they patch up the problem is just push the responsibility and liability outside, right? It's your responsibility because you are going to use my product. Then you're under all responsibility of a security breach. And the spokeswoman told the BBC in this case, but no company that operates online can provide 100% guarantee that it won't be hacked. The first sentence. Actually, this is reasonable. True, right? We agree. It's very hard to achieve 100% perfectness in terms of information security. Then we look at the second sentence. The learning large terms and conditions like T&Cs for many online sites and services simply recognize that the fact by limiting the company's liability for the acts of third parties such as hackers. Such limitations are commonplace on the web. I would not say this is not reasonable. It sounds reasonable as well, but not like truth, because different people may have different opinions. Right? And here I found some, actually after this case, I found some comments from one researcher in legal. Heather Roberts, he says, despite the understandable backlash, unfortunately, from the legal perspective, VTEC is acting entirely within the restrictions of consumer law. So he thinks this patch up on TMC is actually, it's okay. It is within the legal restriction. And is entitled to amend their terms and the conditions as they see fit. So actually they more stand on the company side and say, because this is the right of the company to write, to update their TMC. First I want to ask the question, do you think the patch up on TMC is a ethical action? Yes, I think you got a good point, because the thing has already happened, bad thing happened, and then they revise the condition and terms. This is a not good way, at least not ethical. Any people think, still think this is ethical? You can raise your hand. Okay, basically we agree that we have a common understanding. This is not good way, this is not ethical at all from the perspective of a technology provider. Then we ask another question, is this legal? Just use your hand if you think this is still legal. Okay, almost half of them. And if you think this is illegal, raise your hand. Okay, not so many people think so, but this is relevant to one requirement from GDPR, actually. I will mention this later. It's called basically, if you buy a product, we assume that the company can assume that a customer, they give consent to them, right, to the terms and the conditions. Otherwise, you should not buy our product. Or at least, if you found the terms and the conditions are against your willingness, you can return the product. However, this is all the terms and the conditions. They are actually, we call it implied, right? They didn't ask the customer to actively to make a consent, for example, signature or a tick on the box. Yes. So
you can be responsible for it TMC, but not if it's specifically you have to purchase for products.
Okay. Yes, as far as I know from the facts and also I heard from your comments, my understanding is this is arguable. I see also some people think this is legal, some other people think this is not legal. And here we have the researcher's opinion. They think this is still legal. But I found another opinion actually on this specific case. A privacy lawyer, Ott van Dalen, he think this is a description from him. Under the EU law, you have an obligation to secure data and you cannot waive this by putting something like this in the terms and the conditions that you have with your customer. And you see different people, they really have different opinions. Yes. 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 Good point. It also depends on where you put your servers. So, yes. I will mention this later. This is one of the driving forces of GDPR to just tear down all this difference among different member states about privacy law. Or if we ask this fundamental question, for example, here, if we can generalize this term and the condition perspective, for example, if the company can set up an agreement, personal agreement with each specific customer and ask the customer to sign. If you buy our products, you can sign, you can give a consent. Then it is really explicit consent. If this happens, it is still illegal or not? A lot of room for debate. I don't think that we have a very clear answer. Also depends on different countries. The answer could be very different. But if we follow, let's come back to GDPR, which is going to be a common law across all the EEA and the EU from next year. The principle from GDPR is actually allows the member states to enact laws that restrict the processing of some categories of data, even if the data subject explicitly consents. So that means depends on different member states. They may want to establish their specific regulation based on GDPR, but even higher, even stronger, to protect the customer or individual's privacy. Even in some special cases, the individual give a consent that the data can be used by other third party, but still the national law can think this is illegal. Depends on different situations. Okay, the case, we have a small discussion here and we won't spend more time on that, but the general principle is we should follow GDPR's principle that do pay attention to some special cases, even the customer's explicit consent is not give a good excuse to the company, for example, in this VT, to make a very gross negligence in deploying the information security controls in your products. And now we will talk about other terms, like, for example, policy. What are information security policy? They are expectations that define acceptable and unacceptable behaviors in a working place. And the policies function as laws. It looks like law, but just have a limited scope within an organization. Because this is not a national law, it's only effective within the organization. So you really need to be careful when you write such a policy to ensure that they are complete, they are appropriate, they are fairly applied to all the people. Okay, we can spend another 1 minute on this terms and condition, and any people read the terms and conditions if you buy some electronic devices? Okay, amazing. And we can believe not so many people really read, because it is not really understandable, or you at least need some time to go through all the words. A lot of words or terms are from legal sense. And you have a good arguments that maybe we can come up with some easy to understand way or sentences to replace these terms and conditions to allow the customers to better understand it, right? But actually, what could be the driving force behind this? Do big industries or technology providers, they have this driving force to do this? They will cost more from their deployment. And if there's no demand from the customer perspective, I think this is not realistic to happen in the future. Only if the customers, they have a strong power or willing that we should change this status, then the industry may have the driving force to modify on this, right? Yeah, I got your point. Actually, these points align with the principle of GDPR. That means personal agreements or contract, not always they are regarded as valid if it is grossly breached the privacy of the customer. Yes, I think we can have more discussion offline, but I will continue on this lecture. We come back to the term policy. Any difference between policy and the law? Yes, because ignorance of policy it's still acceptable defense because it is not a breach of law. So your organization will not put you to a prison if you breach the policy. But then the question is, if you are not supposed to be put to the prison, why you should respect the policy of the organization? So then we talk about how to make those policies enforceable. Then as a CISO or information security technician, you should pay attention to the following criteria if you want your information security policy to be really executable in your organization. For example, it should be make it published. It should not be secret, right? It should be disseminated to all the people. And it should be understandable. For example, if I only read English or Chinese, and I will be very puzzled and a Norwegian version of the policy, then I need some people to help me. And it should be understandable. Make sure all the employees, they understand it. For example, by some training, by some small test to evaluate if you understand the policy well or not. And also, it should be agreement signed. Without agreement signed, you can argue that we never received such a policy and because you don't have my signature. And also, it should be enforced uniformly, or say equally to all the persons, without any bias. And also, the last part, also very important, you should list clearly what could be the penalty. The penalty should not be, for example, to be put into prison because you didn't breach the law, but you still, for example, you need some clear list of penalties, for example, to be fired. Talk about the law. So just now we talk about policy, and still we need to know the law, different types, categories of law. And we talk about civil law, which manage the relationship between the organizations and the organization and the people. Criminal law address the violations harmful to the society. Private law, basically, for example, the contract law or personal agreement between person and person without much impact on the whole society, so we call it the private law. And public law regulates the structure, administration of the government agencies, which basically if something happened and has a huge or big impact on society law, society, then we should use public law to regulate it. And we move to the topic of policy. We will spend some time on it, because it is one of the hottest topic nowadays, also against the background of GDPR. I will define it. What is privacy? It is very hard to define. You will see. I will give you some examples later. But here we can roughly say it is a state of being free from unsanctioned intrusion. Still, it is not easy to understand. I will give you examples later. Nowadays, we can find a lot of challenges to privacy in a modern society. For example, the data aggregation. We have our data collected by our smartphones, laptop, or sensors here, everywhere. And all this data can be put together, can be pulled, and a lot of linkage can be found. So a profile about person, about citizen, can be established. Internet and social network, of course, the whole internet works like a big sensor network to sense all the citizens from different countries, what their behaviors, what their the working and lifestyles could be. Public surveillance, like security camera, Internet of Things in the future, new technologies like biometrics, e-health, mobile health, advanced sensing technologies. For example, currently you can find a lot of functionalities from apps which can collect different data. For example, I just 2 weeks ago, I downloaded one app called Physics Toolsuit, which use a lot of sensors embedded in our phones to collect different data. For example, there's accelerometer, G-force, gyroscope, barometer, and even ruler, compass, GPS. So if you activate all these sensors, a lot of information can be collected. And we talk about personalized medicine, DNA analysis, for example. And actually, if we look at, if we date back to the history of privacy, this term, we found interesting story here. Many years ago, when I did a literature survey, actually, I found this literature from almost 1.5 centuries ago. And that time, because of this new technology invention, at that time, people call it dry plate camera. You know, before that, people use a technology they call the white plate. That means if you want to take a picture, you have to keep your objective still, not move. So you ask people sit there for 10 minutes or 15 minutes without moving. And then the picture can be taken because the plate is wet. You need some time to wait the wet plate to become dry. And in year 1879, the dry plate camera was invented, and the people were excited because then they can just take the camera on the street and click, and immediately the picture can be taken. You don't need to wait. Ask the objective to wait. And you can find the people at that time, they immediately this gave a lot of concern to the general public about their privacy. And some researcher at that time, they write a paper named The Rights to Privacy, which was published on Harvard Law Review on year 1890, many years ago. It says that the individual shall have full protection in person and in property is a principle as old as a common law. So that means privacy is quite old concept. It is not new. And people do see the necessity of protection of their self in person and their property. But it has been found that necessary from time to time to define anew the exact nature and the extent of such protection. Also, surprisingly, the researchers at that time, 1.5 centuries ago, they realized the concept of privacy. It is not a fixed term. It's not a fixed concept. It can be defined anew from time to time. So, in sum, we say privacy is a dynamic concept. It's very hard to define. And also it should be kept in concern. It was actually kept in concern since very ancient time. It is not a modern concept. And every time the new technology was invented, they keep bringing challenges to privacy. Well, help define the new extent of privacy. And as we mentioned today, we have a lot of devices. You have a lot of chance to get your data leaked. And by security cameras, for example, and also by the mass surveillance programs launched by governments, like the PRISM from US, I believe you know this, from, for example, the Edward Snowden. And also, for example, in China, people have this great firewall. Basically, the internet in China looks like a very huge local aerial network. And the project, the six projects in Germany, they are all mass surveillance projects launched by governments. And examples of privacy concerns, for example, the medical health data breach. I use this case Anthem data breach in the first lecture of this course. And in the recent years, we can see frequent data breach from other consumer electronic markets, players, and also some internet service players. And even from the government aspects, we did observe one incident from 2013, the years 2013, the civil registry from Denmark was breached. Location-based services by smartphone, biometrics, a lot of other aspects. So it's very complex to define a privacy, what is privacy, and also what could be the requirements of privacy. Different people, they may have different sets of requirements. And also the requirement can be very different under well-road context. Suppose, for example, here I give you an example, if you have an option to use biometrics payment for shopping in a supermarket, basically we have two modes. For example, you can have your smartphone. You can store your biometric template in your phone, and every time you use the app provided by the supermarket and use your fingerprint scanner or face capture to verify your identity. So the data is within your phone and the matching process happened on your phone. And decision is a feedback to the app provided by the supermarket. This is model one. Another model is the sensor and the system is maintained and installed in the supermarket. You don't need your phone. You just go to your supermarket, scan your fingerprints or scan your face. The supermarket can recognize the customer and add the cost to your account. Which mode do you prefer? The first one, using smartphone, your old devices, right? And any people like the second option, you can raise your hand. Okay, first option, you raise your hand. Okay, more people prefer the first option. It is, yes, it is a little bit more friendly in terms of privacy because you have all your data and the devices under your own control, right? Then we have this question. If you can have this option, two modalities, face or fingerprints, to register the program, if the biometric sensor, for example, here on our smartphone, is provided by the supermarket or provided by yourself. But in these two different cases, do you prefer face or fingerprint? Let's go to the first question. Do you prefer face if the sensor is provided by the supermarket, or you prefer fingerprint? If you prefer face, you raise your hand. And you prefer fingerprint? Okay, almost the same, I would say. And in the second case, is you use your smartphone devices. So all the process are under your own control. In this case, you do prefer face, fingerprint. Obviously, more fingerprint than face. Any arguments on this?
Face has a greater chance of changing during an accident.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. You can have also a finger cut or. Yes. Okay. Yes. Okay. So that means the situation, for example, the permanence of biometrics modalities and also the other aspects will influence your decision in this case.
Let's say you want a picture of
Okay, okay. So it is also a challenge in spoofing, right? We call it a spoofing. The blood vessels. We call the vein. Yes. No standard answer. You see, different people, they really, you really have a divided opinion, because it really depends on people's, how you evaluate which part is more important, fingerprint or face. Different people may have different value. Then think more about the difference in terms of privacy using face and the fingerprint. But this is just my opinion. Of course, you should have your own opinion as well. For face, I believe it is relevantly with high exposure degree, because you leave your face on a student card or different profiles or register it in different services already, and a lot of people can recognize you because they can recognize the face, right? And but the only thing is, two person, they may look alike. Still remember the case we talk about in the first lecture, the twins, they're driving the car in the highway. In this case, how can you differentiate? And for the case of fingerprints, it is relatively lower in exposure, because people use less fingerprint than face to registration of different programs. Not really. I can tell you a news about the fingerprint. This happened early last year. I tell you the story. It is a real story in a political convene in Germany. Some political person, they make a speech in public, and the journalist use a very high definition camera. They take a picture, and later he found the fingerprint that can be clearly seen from the picture if you enlarge the scale of the picture. So not always. But still, relevantly, people use fingerprint less frequently than face. And it is hard to capture and search, less links to other identities. So it's less possible to find a match with another person with the same fingerprint. Even twins, they have different fingerprints. So when connecting to other connectees, identities is more of your concern. For example, if you are a celebrity, you are an important person, and you would not like the idea you can leave a trace, you wasted some services, then in this case, you might prefer your fingerprint, because it has less linkage to your other identities, right? And if you are just a normal person, and you don't care your face, and you think your fingerprint is a sensitive data, then you can just use your face. And we have example from ECAL. They really use fingerprint and the face in the implementation of the e-passport. So you know the e-passport, right? So what is e-passport? What is the difference between e-passport and the old version of password? All of these passports, the format and the mechanism for authentication, they are compliant to ICAO's standard, International Civil Aviation Organization. So ICAO specified the standards for all the passport and e-passport on this planet, so that different countries, the citizens from different countries, if they go to another country, the passport can be properly recognized and authenticated, because we need some common standard to do that. And these standards are made by ICAO. And the only difference between e-passport and the passport is, in e-passport, you find a chip. So you found your passport at the first page, or maybe in some countries, second page, or the back page, they are very hard, not easy to bend, right? Because there's a chip inside. So it is more secure than just a paper-based, the old version of a passport. And in the chip, we have two options. The first option, we can just store a digital version of your face photo there. And it was protected by BAC, we call it the basic access control. Some member states or some countries, they can also to enforce another option to add fingerprint data of their citizens to the passport. And they are protected by, we see, EAC, Extended Access Control. There are different secure protocols how to authenticate a passport. The difference between these two is for BAC, the authentication is one way. So this is a reader, passport reader. The passport is authenticated by the reader only. This is one way. By EAC, the authentication is two-way. Why? Because fingerprint data is considered as a sensitive data. It should be better protected. And in this case, not all the readers, they can read the fingerprint from the passport. The two-way authentication indicates the reader need to authenticate the e-passport. Means the reader should make a decision. This e-passport is illegal or not. It is a fake one or not. And in the same time, the e-passport need to authenticate the reader to see this reader is a legitimate. It is not an illegal one, not a stolen one. So this is a two-way authentication. The purpose is because a stolen one, a fake reader, if they can use to read a fingerprint, this is considered as a privacy leakage. We can continue after 5 minutes break. Then I can give you more examples for some discussion. Okay, we continue the lecture. We talk about the complexity to define and define the concept and also define the requirements of privacy. And we have this example of biometric modality chosen. But how to achieve privacy? There should be some common ways. At least we should find some common ground to say, based on this, on top of this common ground, we can do something to enhance some very basic requirement of privacy. And some people, for example, proposed this term, anonymization, as a tool or method to enhance the data privacy. So we can find a similar intention from this Norwegian law called Personal Health Data Filing System and the Processing of Personal Health Data. We found some sentence like this. In Section 7, regional and local personal health data filing systems, the consent is not necessary if regulations provide that the personal health data may only be processed in pseudonymized or de-identified form. Here, the de-identified, you can understand it as a anonymized form. And it talk about the two way to enhance the privacy of the data. Pseudonymization and anonymization. Any people know any difference between these two terms? You can raise your hand. Or not really. Or, they are actually not easy, not that straightforward to explain. Basically, if we say pseudonymization, I can give you an example. For example, in a table, this is a customer data table stored in any server maintained by any service providers. This is account name. This is a, for example, some privacy sensitive data like shopping records. If we say anonymization, a simple understanding is we just remove this part. Okay? So that the shopping records, they are not one-to-one mapped to any specific or unique identity. But still, maybe you can find a lot of indication from the shopping records that you can guess the identity of the buyer or purchaser. In that case, you can further, for example, here, if you record the time, item and others. If the combination of all this information can establish a link to a unique identity, you can further remove some of them, for example, the time, then make it even more anonymized. Anonymize this means it's hard to identify the subject. So this is what we call the anonymization. If we do pseudonymization, then we still maintain this part, but we use a pseudonym. For example, it can be a encryption of account name. With a sort or not. But this is not important. The only thing is you can encrypt the account name so no people can really know the identity. But still, you can keep the key. Here you use a secret key to make the control. Next time, if you want to know the account name from the encrypted version, just use a key to decrypt it. And you store only the pseudonym, the encrypted version, together with the shopping records, and store all this data in the server. And if the server was breached or compromised and all this data are leaked, at least from the attacker's perspective, it's very hard to do the decryption, and they will not know the account name. So this is what we call the pseudonymization. Any questions on this? Good. Normally we say pseudonymization and anonymization, we keep this part open because you keep this part open for ready, make it ready for use, for example, data analysis or statistics. And then we need this two method to surprise the linkage to a specific identity. Of course, you can choose to encrypt everything. Then I don't think it is relevant to these terms. Yeah. So these two can be two tools to enhance the privacy of the data. On the other sections of the same law, I found one another aspect of the privacy. That is the right of access. It defines that any person who so requests shall be informed of the kind of processing of personal data a controller is performing and may demand to receive the following information as regards specific type of processing. Okay, the easy to understand way to understand the sentence is the data subjects, they have the rights to access their own data. So this is easy to understand, right? This is this should be also considered as one aspect of the privacy because that is your data. You have the access rights. I also give you a real case. This happened in the beginning of year 2008. I came here to Hague School of UOWIC early this year, and I participate this EU projects. And this was actually the first EU research project on the Hague School here. And in the research projects, we are going to test some fingerprint privacy enhancing algorithms. And we need to the first step is to establish the database, right? So we collect fingerprints from 100 subjects. They are basically students and staffs working here. And for each person, we capture 10 prints. And we use 6 sensors. You can see the sensors here. They are provided by different project partners in the same project. And we use 12 sensors to collect all the fingerprints. And before the collection, of course, we need the GET approval. This is very important also for you to memorize in your mind. In a later phase, you want to collect any personal data from your customer. You might need get approval from some institute organizations. In this case, we get the approval from NORSC Center for First Glance Data, and we are required by them to anonymize all these data after the project ends, because after the project ends, you don't need to contact all these data subjects. You can keep the data, but not the identities of this data. And we didn't have this question. And that time, should we do this anonymization? And the very end phase of the project, we did have this question because we we think about we should contact the author of the owner of this data if something happened in a later phase. Some real examples pops up in this case. And after the project finished at the February year 2011, we had one data subject, actually a PhD student working here, to knock on my door. He knocks on my door, have a question to me, Bian, can you delete my data from your database because the project finished? I don't want my data to be there anymore. So this is a reasonable and very justified rights, because this is his data. He has the rights to access and also request to delete the data, right? Yes. Then we were actually, at that time we were happy because we do not do the anonymization yet. We didn't do that yet. You can suppose if we anonymize all these data, we remove all the names and the contacts, how can we find the data for this person, right? We are allowed to keep the fingerprint data by NCD, but just anonymize them. That means to delete identities. But in this case, you can see it's not easy to, if you delete all these contact and account name or name, how can you find a person's data if they have this request of data deletion? Yes, the project was done, but we are allowed at the very beginning of the project to keep the data apart. So that is was actually legal, that was allowed. A better way to do anonymization in this case? Yes. That is why I mentioned this pseudonymization. You can just, for example, do encryption and keep this key well kept. Or if you are still worried about encryption, because encryption, it is a two-way. If the key is leaked, some attacker can still reverse the plain text. You can use the hash, for example. This is the name of the subject with some sort. And in this way, you don't need a key, or even the key is leaked. Because of the irreversibility, the attacker cannot get the original name at all, right? And in this case, this PhD student can just tell me his name. And I use this name to calculate the hash, probably with a sort, and I generate this pseudonym name. And use this pseudonym, I can find the fingerprint data in the database. But you see, the right to access the data do have some conflict with the another aspects, anonymization of privacy. So legal regulation itself may have some conflict from different perspective. The only thing is you want to put a law into a practice, you really need to think how to balance these conflicts. And yes, but we talk about the right to access. I use the example of the PhD student. They have the right to access his data. He has the right to request to delete his old data. But this is not always guaranteed. This right is not, you should not take it as guaranteed. You can have this case here. Max Scrams, he is a Australia privacy activist. He requests to see his personal data that Facebook stored on Facebook server, but at the very beginning, Facebook will not like this happen. And finally, they have a lawsuit and they win the case, but this take a lot of time and effort from Max to do that. So you can see all the privacy rights, unless you strive to and you fight for the rights, it is not automatically ready for you to use. Every time you strive, you fight for your privacy, you enhance the privacy for general public. We talk about another interesting thing. That was we call the safe harbor. You know, before October 2015, the U.S. technology providers or internet service providers like Facebook, Google, or big cloud service providers like Microsoft, Amazon, IBM, if they collect the data from the European citizens, they need some legal regulation or legal base to do so, right? Otherwise, they are not allowed to do that. And before October 2015, between EU and the US, they do have the agreement, they call the safe harbor, which enables the big companies from US, they when they collect the data from European citizens, the agreement think this is okay, on the condition that the big companies from US, the service providers, they should take care about information security, they should take care about the protection of their customers' data very, very well, which is aligned to the relevant privacy law in EU. However, because of the Edward Snowden's disclosure on US intelligence services activities on their citizens and also on foreigners, some people think the safe harbor is not sufficient. So the EU Court of Justice, they think safe harbor is not valid. And they, after half a year, or mid of last year, they found a replacement called Privacy Shield. So what is the difference? The Privacy Shield addressed the more stringent, more stronger demands on privacy requirements on the data exchange between US and the EU. For example, they have more requirements on enforcement body, allow some arbitration rights. What is arbitration? Any people know this? It means a freedom for individuals. They negotiate with the technology providers, make a separate agreement. And the mechanisms for disclosure to public authority, the liabilities on onward transfer. And they really tightened the condition for onward transfer. For example, in safe harbor, if Google get your data and transmit it to US, and they can outsource this part, data analysis, to a third party. And if the data is leaked, Google will take the sole, or solely they will take the responsibility. And for this privacy shield, the new agreement, they think if you outsource this part, if Google outsource this part to a third party, the third party should be also qualified and with the same security certification level as Google. So they make the conditions tightened. And also, for example, they have more responsive and proactive supervisions. This before, if the data was leaked, and the service provider should report. And in this case, in the new agreement, they have more weight, more requirement on that the government agencies, they should play an even more active role to supervise, to audit all the transactions. And also they specifically they require that the response to customers' complaints should be done within 45 days. At no cost to the customer. But still, some people criticize the new agreement because it still didn't address the concern from the mass surveillance activities of the US national security agencies on European citizens if the data are transferred to US. That leads to a further one step. We call it US-EU umbrella agreement. So this agreement is on top of the privacy shield, but with one step further, they extend the core of the judicial redress provisions. That is rights. For example, if you are a European citizen, you go to US, in principle, you are not covered by the privacy law of US because you are foreigners. And by this umbrella agreement, the agreement extend this US law, Privacy Act, to US to European citizens as well. So this is a good news. And now you can enjoy the rights, the same rights as as U.S. American citizens. We talk about the privacy difference between the across the borders, across the Atlantic Ocean. Here, even within the member states of the EU, we also observe the discrepancies. For example, in this case, Facebook was fined by Belgium court, this happened 2 years ago, €250,000 per day. So this is really big fine for Facebook. The reason is the Facebook's operation server was established in Ireland and respect only the privacy law in Ireland. That means the Facebook server is working, is operated, serving the citizens, for example, in Norway. But they use the law in Ireland. So this is not really good because the different member states, they have different privacy law regulations on this part. And why they set up the server and they use the law in Ireland? Just because during the years, many years ago, Ireland have very good policy about privacy protection and also to attract investment from American companies. And this is one, I believe this is one of the driving force and for the GDPR. The situation was different member states, they have a difference in terms of privacy law. Then this is actually a barrier to foreign companies, like companies from America. Then the European member states, they really need a common law so that among each different member states, they have a common understanding and they have common regulations on privacy. And this is a motivation of the GDPR. We mentioned this many times in our course. We talk about the privacy. We spend a lot of time. Of course, if you look at our textbook, we found other aspects, for example, ethics, which is also very important aspects. And in our textbook, you also find a list of computer ethics. I will not go to the details. For example, they say you shall not use a computer to harm other people, you shall not interfere with other people's computer network, and so on. They are ethicals, so they are not a law, they are not regulation, they are even not a privacy within organizations. But still, if you are professionals, you are encouraged to respect these ethics, because only if all the professionals and the people have a common standing and a common set of ethicals, people can communicate and stand each other better. And ethic criterions can differ from country to country. Here from our textbook, they use a very good example, I think. For example, they think what could be the difference about the ethical aspects. They use several case examples. For example, I came from China. Originally, we have the culture. For example, if you use a public resource, if you're sitting in the office, you want to print a couple pages of your personal private mail, use the printing paper provided by the organization and the printers in your organization, that was regarded as not ethical. But here in Norway, unless you stole a lot of printing papers there, you just use a couple of pages, no people will blame you, right? I think people think this is okay. So this is a difference across cultures in terms of information security ethics. But you may heard a lot that in East Asia countries, the copy issues, the copyright issues. People do not think this is very serious issue because people think they think they didn't really harm other people very well. But here, software license and IPR, they are really regarded as serious legal issues. You should not infringe them. You should not. You really should take serious of them. So this is also a difference in terms of culture. And we don't have so much time to go through all the U.S. laws. You may have found some time to go through this chapter from our textbook. And for example, in U.S., they have a lot of laws. We talk about the HIPAA in previous lecture, which is a very typical case, but it is dedicated to the healthcare domain. And we also talk about the HIPAA's update version in our textbook, for example, the HITECH and the HIPAA's amendments in three or four years ago. The difference is HIPAA, they think the liability of security breach still lies on HCO, that's healthcare organizations, but by the updated version of HIPAA and all the new act HITECH, they extend the liability from the healthcare organizations to associate partners. What are associate partners? Yes, if they also some IT service or equipment building or system building services to another IT service provider, then in that case, the IT service providers, they should share the liability with the healthcare organizations as well. This is defined by the new HITECH law in US. Except one case, we call the common carrier. So what is common carrier? Yes, ISP or internet service provider or network providers, or in the public transportation system, the bus. They are just tools. They are not really undertake any specific task from the organization, right? And other laws to regulate the identity management, for example, here. And also the export and the espionage laws, the copyright laws. I want to say more about the copyright laws here. Laws about the financial reporting. Our textbook gave a very good argument why this financial reporting law was important and was emphasized in U.S. because of this scandal. And the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, DMCA, which was a hot term since year 2000 because of the spreading of this media content by internet. You know, with the flourish of the internet since year 2000, a lot of people can have illegal copies shared and consumed. And this law should fit in this case. And in EU, we have this European Council Cybercrime Convention. And they established international task force to oversee internet security functions for standardized international technology laws. They attempt to improve the effectiveness of international investigations into breaches of technology law. But they are convention. They are not really the Congress of the European Parliament to establish a law, so they lack realistic provisions for enforcement. Another topic, we don't have enough time, but we can go quickly through the list. That is the GDPR. We emphasize this many times because we have this background. The next year, May the 25th, we have GDPR to enter into force to all the EEA and the EU member states. So you should really know exactly what is the difference between GDPR and its previous directive, EU directive. And before we have this directive, we call the EU directive on data protection. And now, from next year, we have GDPR. GDPR is a regulation. R is a regulation. Any people know the difference between EU directive and the regulation? So the difference is EU directive, they are not directly a law. So it is a basic principle. Once EU specify a directive, then all the member states, including EU, EEA states like Norway, each member state, they should establish their national law, which respect the principle listed by the EU directive. For example, in Norway, we have this Personal Data Act to respect, to as a correspondence to the EU directive on data protection. But GDPR, it is regulation. It is a common law through all the member states. The difference is if you establish a national law in Norway, you need the approval from the Congress, right? But if it is a European law, you don't need it. It is a law immediately. You don't need approval from member states Congress. For GDPR, you should memorize all this list. For example, it will generate impacts on data security and breach notification. It specifies the regulation, how, in which cases you should report, and which with a time limit, and to whom, and how you notify the data subjects. And each organization, they should nominate a DPO, data protection officer. And they demand an explicit consent from the data subjects. And they have clear regulations on cross-border data transfer, on data portability, the right to be forgotten. These two, data portability and the right to be forgotten, they are really new. They are different from this EU directive. And the vendor management, pseudonymization as a recommended tool. We explained what pseudonymization is. And the code of conduct, the certification, consequences for GDPR violation. This is also very different from the EU practice because it gives specific numbers of fine, if the penalty, some security breaches was happened, the organization should be fined with a specific number. Some of the points are very important. I listed here, for example, data breach notification. They have a strict requirement. For example, within the notification should be done within 3 days. And consent, the consent should not be implied. For example, we record the terms of the case of VTech. They modify the terms and the conditions. But terms and conditions, this is something without active party approval from the buyers, right? The buyers can choose to read these descriptions of terms and conditions or choose not to read through it. But by GDPR will require that a active consent. That means either a tick of the box or a signature. And data controller should approve the consent. That means the burden of proof should lie on the side of the service provider instead of the customer. And consent may be withdrawn at any time. If the customer say, I want to withdraw our concern, at which date, then they should respect this request. Data portability. That means two implications. The first implication is access of rights. So that means, for example, you have a patient. You demand all your patient journal or information, medical information, to be delivered, transferred to you from the hospital or from the general protection practitioner, they should respect the law to give your old data. The second implementation is you can request, for example, your medical record from hospital one to transfer directly to another hospital. So they should respect the law to do this transaction. And also the portability implies that all the data you received or all the data they transferred among different service providers, they should be in a readable form and standard form. So that means the data you can browse or you can read, you can open them, use a common software like a Microsoft Word or other text editor. You should not be a very hard or specific format, and not so many people they know how to take a look. But exclusion is anonymized data. Anonymized data are excluded from this requirement of data portability. But only one case, you should pay attention to this regulation. One case exception. If, for example, the data has been assumed anonymized, in this case, for example, we come back to this case, if we do not use pseudonymization and we just remove all these identities, then it seems that all data are not identifiable. So all data, we can think they are anonymized. But except one case, for example, after a month or after 1 year, a couple of years, one subject, they can provide external extra information. If you are the data subject, you can provide extra information that can be used to establish the link between the information with one record. To prove that record is yours, then these data are not regarded as being anonymized and all. So in that case, you have the rights to demand the service providers to either to delete your data or to do more further step to achieve better anonymization. This is one exception case. Right to be forgotten, that is the right data subject are entitled to require a controller to delete their personal data if the continual processing of this data is not justified. For example, I give the example of the PhD students. He requested us to delete his fingerprint data from the database. This is their right of the right to be forgotten, because if they think we already finished the projects, we should not use the data any longer, then they have the rights to do so. Sanctions, that means the penalties. If some people breach the law, breach the GDPR, what could be the penalty? So two level of the consequences. For the first level, it specifies the number of the fine. It will be 20 million euro or 4% of the global annual turnover for the organization, for the company, from the previous year. Which number is larger, then we will use this number. Obviously, this is for the more serious data breach. For example, we call some incident, they are caused by this gross negligence, then we may use this term. Or a vacant level, for others, only 10 million euro or 2% of the global income. So you see the sanctions, the fine, they are very serious. So that is one of the reasons you should keep it in mind and also promote the idea of GDPR and make other people, as more people as know, as you can, to make it known to the general public that could be very good. Because as far as I know, not so many companies in Norway, especially SMEs, small and middle-sized enterprise, they are really aware of this regulation. And we have another directive, that is the EU Network and Information Security Directive, which has been taken into effect since the summer of last year. And I will leave it to you as a homework because we don't have sufficient time. Think about one thing, because today we talk about a lot of personalized services. In medicine, we talk about personalized medicine. For example, the IBM Watson. You know the IBM Watson doctor, Dr. Watson? Yeah, they use this artificial intelligence or machine learning software to analyze the data collected from the patient and the patient groups and make better suggestions on diagnosis. And this is a great use of data analysis. And then they can use this data to make a personalized medicine plans for a specific patient. So the assumption is the patient, they allow the data collection from themselves. Then they can get some personalized advice and service in terms of health. So this is a case, the example we talk about the personalized services. Another case, example of personalized services, you might know the internet searching engine, like a Google. They use also machine learning algorithms to notice that what are the topics you have interest. Then they will push more intents within your interest scope. So this is what we call social media. Also, you found this in social media. For example, if you like some topic from your circulated by some message circulated by your friends in your Facebook, then you might in a later phase get more similar information or messages with similar topic. So this is what we call the social media bubble. And for example here, a good example is last year, the US, the American election activities. So the two parties, the supporters, they are really divided, partially due to the social media's as a driving force behind them. Because if you like some opinions from some people, then you will see more and more opinions from your social network. Then you might have this delusion that actually a lot of supporters share the same opinion as you, but was actually not always this case, right? This is another example of personalized service. So you can see some pros and cons of such personalized services. But the question here I want you to discuss and answer. I leave it as a homework to you. If you have some opinions, send it to me by 12 o'clock on Monday, and then I can also give you some feedback. So the question is, legal or regulation, they should treat all the people in an equal way, right? Then it's very hard to get a personalized services. And how to do a good balance between personalized services and the regulation. Is that possible in the future? We can also make a personalized, for example, personalized legislation process. I want your opinion on this topic. Okay, we conclude this lecture. And do remember in the afternoon session, we have this practical.